Hey there, and thanks for listening to our Big Time Talker podcast on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Burke Allen here from our studios in Washington, D.C., which unfortunately still consists of my kitchen table because I've been hunkered down and sheltering in place for the most part since March. Thank you wherever you are listening today, and thank you to our sponsor, SpeakerMatch.com, for making this all possible. SpeakerMatch is the world's largest online virtual speakers bureau. So if you're a keynote speaker or you're a meeting planner, find one another at SpeakerMatch.com. The year 2020 has been tough for many, many industries, perhaps first and foremost, the entertainment and live event industry. And so I wanted to talk to a veteran of that world who's been making a living making music for the better part of 5 decades now. He's my friend Ron Soule. And if you know the name Ron Soule, you may know it from National Public Radio's Mountain Stage, which is heard on a couple of hundred radio stations around the country every weekend. And Ron, for many years, has been the musical director there. But he's got a pretty varied background in the music industry. We're going to talk to him about how he's dealing in pandemic times and his incredible career and all the folks he's played with. Ron Soule, welcome to the Big Time Talker podcast.
Hey, Burke, how are you? Thanks for having me on.
Well, you know, I figured you could squeeze me in today because you're not gigging a whole lot these days.
You have a tremendous talent for understatement.
Hey, you are a Southwest native. You grew up in Roswell, New Mexico. So I have to ask, what's the story in Roswell?
Well, I tell you, Burke, it answers a lot of questions about a lot of the people that I went to high school with.
Oh, you know, I see.
When I went to my first high school reunion, we don't really have a hotel in Roswell. It's a big motel. Okay. It was a very nice one. But anyway, so you walk in the lobby, and there was a desk. It was a V-shaped desk. And down one side, it said, with a big banner, it said, "Welcome, alumni, Roswell High School," okay? And then on the other side, it said, "Welcome, International UFO Convention."
Oh, my.
So here's what I will tell you about it. We didn't talk really about it when I was growing up, but I did when, later on. I had a high school friend who was a daughter of Walter Haught, who was the information officer for the Army Air Force, who released the story to the press. And I asked him about it years later, and I said, "Was this real?" And he said, "Well, all I can tell you is that one day that I was told it was a UFO, and I released it to the press. And a couple of days later, they came back to me and said, 'No, take it all back. It was a weather balloon.'" So that was one thing. And another thing was I used to play Little League baseball, and the president of our league also owned KGFL, which was the local radio station.
Okay.
And he interviewed the rancher that, you know, where the UFO allegedly crashed on his ranch. A couple of days later, the FCC called him and said, "If you do another interview, we're going to pull your license." So all I can say is I don't know exactly what happened, but whatever it was, they, being the government, tried really hard to cover it up.
What an interesting place to grow up. And when in your growing up did all this happen? Did this all predate you?
Oh, yeah. This is the year I was born was the year that the crash happened. And so you can draw your own conclusions there.
Yeah, I think we'll probably leave that alone.
My mom gets a little upset about
that. Now, is it true that you were the student body president at your high school there in Roswell, New Mexico?
No, not in high school. When I went to Eastern New Mexico University, I was a student body president there.
That's even more impressive. So you were the student body president at your university. And also I read that you were considering becoming an attorney and having a real job all through college.
Yes, and much to my father's disappointment, who I have to say, was a very talented singer and harmonica player in his own right. But he was in real life, he was a banker, and he was very responsible. And after all his hard work of putting me through college, you can imagine his delight when I told him that I decided not to go to law school as I had planned, that I was packing my guitar and all my earthly belongings in my car and driving to Dallas, which was the nearest biggest city, and getting a job playing at a local steak and ale.
Yeah, I'm sure that went over really well with Dad the banker.
Oh yeah, he was thrilled about that. His response to me, Burke, was do it until you get it out of your system. I'm still trying.
Here we are after all these years. All right, so you graduated from college and moved to Dallas when? What year?
1970.
Wow. So that was an interesting time in American history. You'd just gone through the race riots in the late 60s,
yeah.
And there was a big youth culture happening all over the
yeah.
country. So sort of paint that picture. Yeah. What was the music scene in Dallas like in 1970?
Well, you know, it was now, of course, you know, this was like in college, it was coming out of the folk. I was always a folk, kind of a folk musician. But, you know, that the 60s, the music was just incredible. Just all these different influences were coming together. And I moved to Dallas. I got a job at a Steak and Ale. But the job that I really liked was was the opening act at a little club called the Rubaiyat in Dallas. And I opened up for people like Ray Wiley Hubbard and Michael Martin Murphy and that club spawned Jerry Jeff Walker and all these legendary Texas musicians and the country and rock were coming together. Country rock really was starting to happen in Texas. And well, the other guy, I have to tell you, this is a little story, interesting story. The other guy who was doing the opening acts for at the Rubaiyat, we alternated every other week, and we got paid $75. That was not a night; that was for the whole week.
Oh my!
And his name was B.W. Stevenson.
Take a letter, Maria.
There you go. Which we called him Buckwheat back then, and Buckwheat he got discovered right there. The guy from the Columbia Records lived in Dallas and came in and auditioned him and gave him a record contract, and he hired one of the other guys who was a regular at the club, a guy named Mickey Raphael, who played harmonica, and in his band, which about 2 years later, Willie Nelson stole him, and he's been with Willie Nelson and still is to this day playing harmonica in Willie Nelson's band. So.
So if you're just joining us, Ron Soles, our guest today on the Big Time Talker podcast, and we're talking about his early music career in Dallas. Today, many people know you as the musical director for Mountain Stage, mm-hmm. the host and one of the creators of that show, Larry Gross, also from that era and also from that area. He grew up in Dallas. Did you guys ever run up against each other back in those days?
You know, very interesting, Bert. He started out at the Rubaiyat as well, but I missed him by about a year. He had already left and when I came in, and I remember one of the guys who was running the club at the time looked at me one day and says, you know, you kind of remind me of this guy who used to play here, Larry Gross. I think you guys would really like each other. I'm serious. But it took me about another 9 years or so to meet Larry, even though we both moved to West Virginia independently. So
when you look back on your father's advice and, you know, you should have stayed in college and you should have gone on to law school, become an attorney. There had to have been some nights in Dallas where you're making $75 a week, a lot of ramen noodle evenings there. Were there times where you thought, what the hell have I done here?
You know, Burke, those ramen noodle evenings followed me for quite some time, all the way to West Virginia, actually. When I was filling out my LSATs, paperwork to take my exam to get into law school, I actually physically froze up. I could not, I could not fill it out. I went, what's going on? And I realized that I really don't want to do this.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, what do I want to do? And I thought, I asked myself the most important question, the realistic question that any musician could ask themselves. And that is, what would I do even if I didn't get paid for it? You know, which turned out to be prophetic for quite some time, because I did it and didn't get paid for it.
All kind of played out that way.
Played out that way. But I said, well, you know, it's music. And then I realized it's not that I wanted to be a musician, Burke. I realized that I was. And to be anything else would not to be true to myself. And it was like the clouds opened up and the ray of sunshine shone on me. And I had that moment of lucidity. I've never looked back. I've never regretted my decision. And it's been a wonderful ride. And it was really, you know, financially, it was rough. It was pretty on the edge for years, but it always worked out. And I just, I love what I do. And I just can't imagine. I mean, music has taken me all over the world and in every different strata of social strata of society. And you know, I have beautiful friends, and I to this day, you know, I just can't imagine doing anything else or ever not doing it.
Well, you know, you're not alone in the arts. There are lots of folks that spend lots of time struggling, whether they're painters or they're actors. There's a famous story of Brad Pitt when he first moved to Los Angeles. For a long time, wore a chicken suit to hustle up diners at a fast food place. Did you ever wear a chicken suit, or what was your worst gig that you had to do to feed yourself?
I didn't wear a chicken suit, but I did do singing telegrams.
Really?
And I had to wear a baby, you know, like a giant diaper and booties and a bib and everything. And that was one of my costumes. And another one was a fairy costume where I had to wear leotards and this tutu, and I had wings, and I had I thought I was going to get beat up one night at a racetrack parking lot going in to do a singing telegram. I remember passing these two guys, and one guy said to the other, "What the hell was that?" And every time I would make like $50 to do this, okay? And every time I would go, I pull up with my car and I go, this is the worst gig. This is the worst, most humiliating moment of my life. I will never do this again. I'm just going to do this once. I'm going to get it over with. And then this is the last one. And then I go in and somewhere and completely embarrass myself. And I come back out and I go, I just made $50. Well, it wasn't that bad.
You know, the diaper was a little snug, but yeah, it's fine. I don't mind the booties. And
So I can empathize with Brad and his chicken suit.
And yet you were still making a living in the music business. And here you are in my home state of West Virginia, which I dearly love. And you're one of those West Virginians by choice. And I have to again, go back to your father's advice. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm Ron Soul. I'm a young, talented musician. I'm going to strike out and make it in the music business. I'm going to head to Los Angeles? No. I'm going to head to Nashville? No. New York? No. No, I'm going to go to West Virginia.
Yeah, well.
So you want to walk me through that thought process just a little bit?
Well, Burke, let me just say, I've never really excelled at planning.
I see.
You know, but what happened is I lived in Dallas. I lived in Cincinnati. I lived in New Orleans for a year.
That's a great really music fun. Town. See,
great music town. And then I applied to be on the coffee house circuit, and so I got booked all over the country. And I had a job in Wheeling, West Virginia, at Wheeling College, and I had a couple of days off. And one of the guys I had met in New Orleans, a friend of mine named Bob Webb, was living on a farm right out in Putnam County, right outside Hurricane, Culloden, West Virginia. And I went to visit him for a couple of days and just fell in love with West Virginia, the land and the people. And I thought, well, this is a beautiful place. And I'd love to live here, but I'll never be able to make a living, you know, playing music here. And this place has totally proved me wrong. I had two long-term original bands that we traveled up and down the East Coast and all over the world, and on a couple of USO tours. And then this show, Mountain Stage, grew up in my backyard. And here we are, like 36 years later, still doing it. And with all the best, greatest musicians in the whole world come and see us every week. I don't even have to travel anymore. They all come to see me. So
I love your description of the state. And as a guy who grew up there, I know why I love it and why it's in my heart. But when people ask you, you know, what it is about West Virginia that has caused you to select it, to be a West Virginian by choice and to stick with it for all these years, what are the first things that come to mind?
Well, first of all, I have to say, in the words of Larry Gross, he said, you know, I wasn't born in West Virginia, but I got here as quick as I could.
Yeah.
So it's two things. The two things that I mentioned. One is that the land is just stunning. It's just beautiful. And I mean, I'm living in the middle of Charleston, West Virginia. I'm looking out my backyard at woods. I'm 5 minutes from downtown.
Right.
You know,
right.
The whole state is like that. And the people will do anything for you. And God help you if you have a flat tire on the interstate, because people would literally wreck their cars getting in line
will line up to help you. I always tell people around that people in West Virginia will give you the shirt off their back, even if they don't currently have a shirt on. You know, they'll run out to the Dollar General and they'll get you a shirt.
They'll get you one.
That's right.
That's right. The people are truly amazing. And when I first started here, we had this little commune, that this group of farms that we, a bunch of us bought land and together, and a bunch of us were musicians and living on the farm, and the band grew out of that, and we started getting all these gigs, and people said, well, you know, you're gonna have to do all this cover music because being a songwriter, they said, you know, people, you'll never make a living playing playing original songs. And the people in West Virginia just totally proved that wrong. I mean, it's funny, Burke, just almost every time I've made a big leap, whether it's Mountain Stage or doing original music or whatever, people almost always say, well, you know, you can never make a living doing this.
And yet here you are.
Yeah.
What do you think, one last West Virginia question, what do you think people get wrong about that state? Yeah, you're a well-traveled guy. You said you've toured all over the country, all over the world.
Yeah.
What do people get wrong about the Mountain State?
Well, people kind of delight in putting West Virginia down because of the stereotypes, you know, the hillbilly, nobody wears shoes, and we're all married to our sisters, and all those things. Well, you know, Burke, you can find those things.
Yes.
You know, those stereotypes do exist, but it is so much more than that. And there's, you know, you get some of the most intelligent interesting and educated people I've ever met live right here in West Virginia. You know, there are great musicians. I mean, Bill Withers and Brad Paisley and Kathy Mattea. I mean, I mean, just Charlie, the great harmonica player, Charlie McCoy. And of course, I'm being a songwriter, you know, people like Bill Withers and Billy Ed Wheeler and legendary Hazel Dickens, legendary songwriters are from here.
And very diverse. The music scene is very diverse, and I think that's something that surprises people. You know, Billy Cox, who played bass for Jimi Hendrix, is a West Virginia guy, you know?
That's right. That's right.
Fred Sonic Smith from the MC5, you know, was married to Patti Smith, a West Virginia guy. It's just amazing.
You're just doing anybody, any place a disservice by putting a label on them and just judging them by that. In West Virginia, if you just look it just slightly beneath those stereotypes, you'll find an amazing culture.
You mentioned, and I'm not going to let you off the hook on this, that you lived in a commune in the hills of West Virginia. This is when I first became aware of you. This is when you put together with some other folks the Putnam County Pickers. And
that's right.
And I can just imagine what that scene was like, you know, right out of an R. Crumb comic book from the mid-70s. You know, you got the hippies on the commune picking and grinning. What was it really like when you put together the Putnam County Pickers?
Well, you know, first of all, we lived in an assortment of old farmhouses, tree houses, teepees, lean-tos. I mean, we were literally just a bunch of college educated, but hippies. We're back to the land. We wanted to, there was a real draw at that time to be close to the land and the land was cheap in West Virginia and beautiful. And so, we were drawn to that. And what was it, that question you, I'm sorry, I'm straying.
You know, like a good hippie would from, you know, back.
Like a good, yes. Now what it was like, okay. The Putnam County Pickers, we used to get together. We were all in our 20s and we used to get together and, about 2-3 times a week and with communal parties. And we'd be musicians. We would, you know, get out our guitars and sing and play. And the band just sort of developed out of that. I didn't really plan to be in a band. In fact, I resisted it as long as I could, but we got so many gigs and so many people wanted us to play that here and there. I'll tell you what, here's how it was, Brooke. Here's how hard we made it for people to book us.
Okay.
We did not have a phone on the farm. This was pre-cell phone,
sure,
of course. The only way you could get in touch with us was at the local post office, the Culloden Post Office. And if somebody wanted to book us, they would call the postmaster at the post office. He would take a note, and when one of us would come in to get our mail, he would say, "Hey, listen, so and so at Point Pleasant at the Mason County Fair wants to book you. Here's their phone number."
Wow!
So we made it really hard on people, but we eventually got a phone on the farm. It was installed in an old chicken coop.
It sounds like this was somewhat begrudgingly that you got the phone to begin with.
Yeah, it was great though. It was romantic and it was hard too. I mean, you know, we had to eat by wood and the road got muddy and we had to hike through the woods with our groceries it gave me a very strong appreciation for modern technology, but it was also really, really just an incredible experience.
The Putnam County Pickers were somewhat typical of artists in that era in that you could have a really big regional following and you could eat off that regional following. You know, it was pre-MTV and pre sort of the nationalization of music. And so you guys were quite successful. What was the highlight of your time with the Pickers?
Well, of course, we did a couple of USO tours. We did one to Greenland. We did one to the Mediterranean and Ethiopia and Turkey. We used to play in New York quite a bit at the Lone Star Cafe, which was billed as the largest country music venue in New York City, in Manhattan. And We opened for a lot of really great people there. We used to play the Wheeling Jamboree quite frequently. Wow. And the guy who booked that also booked the Jamboree in the Hills, which is 70,000 people, you know, country music fans. And we got booked on Jamboree in the Hills. And I, Burke, I don't mean we just got booked like second tier. Yeah, we were, it's the posters there on the very top said Emmylou Harris, Bill Monroe, Alabama, Hoyt Axton, Putnam County Pickers.
Wow.
we thought we were going to, that was our big, you know, huge break. And we were going to be, it was all going to be easy street from there on, but it didn't quite work out.
It's a good thing those folks had the phone number at the Culloden post office to track you down.
Really? No, we would have never gotten that gig. And also, when we pulled up to the gate to park our brown step van, which we loaded with our equipment and all the band members, the guy wouldn't let us in, and we had to pull out our contract. We had to prove who we were, and we thought, well, what, this sucks. What's this? So a little later we understood. We pulled up in the parking lot, and about 30 minutes later comes Emmylou Harris's Silver Eagle, you know, $200,000 bus. And then there's Bill Monroe's big Greyhound Silver Eagle. And then there's Alabama's, and then Hoyt Axton, the Honeysuckle Rose, the one the movie was made
out
of. That's right. It was an old double-decker Greyhound. And then that parked right beside our little step van. And you know, in New York City, when they built those huge skyscrapers, and there'd be one person in a little convenience store that wouldn't sell out, you know. Yes. So they would keep there'd be this huge skyscraper, but in one little corner on the first floor, there'd be this little convenience store. That's what it looked like. It looked like all these skyscrapers, and then our little modest step van. But that was a really fun experience. We followed Alabama on the stage.
Oh my!
Which is not really, which is very exciting, but it really isn't a very good idea. Nobody knows who you are.
Well, you know, if you have Alabama as your opening act, that's got to say something, though. You know, Alabama opened for us.
That's true, and that's literally true. That's literally true.
And you said, you know, you felt like you're right on the cusp of things, but it didn't work out. What was the end of the Pickers?
Well, shortly after that, we had kind of come to the end of our run, and we were being kind of pulled apart musically in different directions, and also, you know, I developed this thing called band years. You know, dog years is 7 to 1,
right?
7 years to 1.
Right.
And when you're in a band, it's a very intense experience. And so I developed this band years, which is 3 to 1. So in the Pickers, we were together about 7 years, which is in band years is like 21 years. So that's a long time to stay together. And then I took a year off after that and let the insanity build once again. And then I put it together another band, which is called Stark Raven.
And you know, when I did radio in West Virginia in the late 80s at WKEE, there was our midday talent music director was a guy named Rick Swan. And Rick Swan was a huge supporter of Stark Raven. And I remember the album coming in. Yeah. I remember you guys coming in for interviews, and you were on your way.
Yeah. You know, it was really a kind of a cutting edge band, Burke, and on Mountain Stage, I see almost every week, I'll see some band that kind of looks like what we were doing at the time, because we combined folk music and rock music and classical music, and we had an electric violin, electric cello, a rock and roll rhythm section, and three singers. And then also we had one guy who played dulcimer and mandolin, and we had hammer dulcimer and you know, acoustic instruments. It was a real blend, and we were just, it was really a really very, very, very good band, and I think the albums still hold up well today. But we were just a little ahead of our time, I think.
And Gene Cotton produced one of those albums, as I recall.
No, he contributed a song. We did one of his songs. I forget which one it was, but there was a guy from Spanky in our gang. His name was Oz Bach, and he had moved to West Virginia, and he really became enthralled with us. And he's the one that connected us with this guy we worked with in New York, and we got to go to New York on a regular basis, and he ended up producing at least partially produced our first album. Yeah.
With Stark Raven, you guys did, again, you toured regionally and had some other, you know, very, very close calls. And when that one didn't pan out to be, you know, a big national breakthrough,
right,
was there a time where you said, you know what, I can't do the band thing anymore? You know, I'm going to sink or swim on my own.
Yeah.
If I'm going to be the captain of the Titanic, I want to steer my own ship, so to speak.
No, that's very true. No, I did two bands, and that was like the second band lasted 9 years, and that was 16-17 years worth of bands. And of course, in band years, that's it's a long time.
Yes.
I decided that I did not want to do a band anymore. But you know, I started out as a solo singer songwriter, so it was pretty natural for me to fall back into that. But at the same time, the last couple of years of the band of Stark Raven, this show Mountain Stage took hold. Actually, Burke, just to step back for a moment, the pilot of Mountain Stage, the Putnam County Pickers, we did the pilot.
Okay.
I joined Mountain Stage. Well, with the two women in our band, Stark Raven, Julie Adams and Denny Bonet, joined. They were on the first Mountain Stage that was on the air. They were on the first one, and Larry Gross hired them on the spot. And then later, our bass player, and then our drummer, and then me. Five of the six of us in Stark Raven ended up being the Mountain Stage band. So, that became a kind of a natural evolution for me. You know, it put me off the road about the time my daughter was born, which was very, very fortuitous. I mean, it only took about two or three times of coming in at 5 o'clock in the morning from one of the Saturday night gigs and making my 9 o'clock sound check at Mountain Stage to convince me that maybe I should curtail the the traveling a little bit.
Perhaps it's time for a change.
but that was, you know, gosh, that was Mountain Stage is just what a gift. If you told me back then I could leave my house on Sunday and drive 10-15 minutes to a theater and be with some of the greatest musicians on the planet virtually every week, you know, I would have wanted to smoke whatever what you were smoking.
That's right. Share that with me now.
But,
I love that.
Yeah. But it's true. It's, you know, we're a crossroads now, gotten to see it, meet and play with and experience a lot of my heroes.
And how great is it you get to do that as the music director of the Mountain Stage band? Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of the folks that you played with before in Stark Raven. So unlike band breakups that are very, acrimonious and people just don't ever speak again, it sounds like that was not at all the case. It all kind of worked out. And you guys get to maintain that musical bond.
No, I would say with maybe one or two exceptions in all the people that I played with in the band, we are lifelong friends and brothers and sisters to me. We're family. And the Mountain Stage band, For instance, Ahmed, the drummer on Mountain Stage, was in the Putnam County Pickers and Starkraven. So he and I have literally played with each other since like 1976, 77, something like
That's
that.
That's crazy.
Steve Hill, who's the bass player of Mountain Stage right now, and it was the guitar player in the Putnam County Pickers, was the guy I met in New Orleans in 1970. So, I used to think that sounded kind of old, but you know, now that you got Mick Jagger and you know, all these guys, you know, those guys are, you know,
you're a young whippersnapper in comparison.
I'm a young guy. Yeah.
So, if you're just joining us on the podcast, our guest is Ron Soule. He's the music director of Mountain Stage. What does that mean? If you're not a musician, if you're just a fan, and maybe you've listened to Mountain Stage on National Public Radio or seen the TV show, what's your gig? What do you do besides play backup guitar with some folks?
Well, I play guitar and I play harmonica and background harmonies. Occasionally, I step out front and sing one of my own songs, but that's kind of rare occurrence these days. But my most important gig is that December, our next show is on December 6th. Daryl Scott, who is an amazing singer-songwriter who's written multiple hits for a lot of big-time country people. He's an incredible musician. He's coming on the show, and he's without a band, and he's going to use the band. So he sends me his album. He tells me what songs he wants to use the band on. By ear, I will sit down and chart the songs, which means just basically do our own little system of writing chords and cymbals and so forth that the all of us understand. I choose the parts that each person will play. I send it out to them, to the band. They all do their homework on their own, and then on Sunday we get together at soundcheck, and we have about 45 minutes with the artist, and we'll play three or four, sometimes five songs with them, and then we'll do that in soundcheck, and then about 3 or 4 hours later we go out and we're live on the air and we'll play that with the artist. So it's my job to make sure that all comes off, and that the band is, I communicate with everybody in the band and keep them informed. And then every week, Julie Adams, one of our band members, is featured on a song, and we always play a song with her. So I'm in charge of making sure that goes smoothly too.
Now, I think for folks that aren't musicians, and even for some folks who are musicians, they would be amazed that these artists oftentimes, most times, will walk out on that stage with you for soundcheck, having never met, much less performed with any of you before, and you're able to lock it into a cohesive thing like that. Does it always work? Are there ever times where you just don't vibe and it doesn't come together?
You know, because we have played together for so long, and because I have there is strength in numbers, and because I have ultimate faith in everybody in the band to do their homework, to be prepared, 99% of the time it works out beautifully. There have been some train wrecks but you know, here's the deal with live music. I explain it like this. Some people go to the Indianapolis 500 to see the cars go fast. Some go there to see them crash. And if you don't have an occasional crash, then, you know, where's the tension? You know, where's the drama? And so I think we don't always get it perfectly. We usually get the spirit of it. But yes, it's very common for an artist to come out, and the only person they have spoken with is me on the phone. So.
And these are big names. I'm just looking at some of the folks that you've either played with or that you work with on Mountain Stage. Lyle Lovett, yeah. Sarah McLachlan, Judy Collins, Gordon yeah. Lightfoot. I mean, Bruce Hornsby, yeah. Richie Havens,
yeah.
R.E.M., the Nitty Gritty yeah. Dirt Band, Joan Baez, Emmylou Harris, Livingston Taylor. I mean, those are some pretty heavy hitters. So are there knee-knocking moments for you whenever you meet somebody like that in person for the first time? You're
God,
nervous
yes.
to be on the same stage with them?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't really get nervous anymore, although I did in the early days. But they're absolute heroes of mine. I mean, I met Paul. I was a big Peter, Paul, and Mary fan.
Right.
my folky background, and I met Paul Noel Suki. And I was just a stammering fool because, you know, this guy was, he was somebody I listened to for hundreds of hours on, and there've been people like that. Judy Collins, I got to play, Last Thing on My Mind, which is the Tom Paxton song, anthem, famous folk song.
Sure.
Which is the first song that I learned to fingerpick to. And then I ended up getting to play it on the stage with Judy Collins, you know, and Tom Paxton. I played with him too. Just amazing. I backed up Mike Seeger, which is one of the Seeger clan, you know,
yep.
Pete Seeger, the family, Peggy Seeger. He was playing banjo. He asked me to play back him up. And so I got my guitar and he said, no, I would like for you to play this. And he pulls out this ukulele and he said, can you play this? And I said, well, I guess I can.
I can now.
so we were practicing back in his dressing room and there was a knock at the door and he goes, answers the door and Arlo Guthrie, who was next door, the next dressing room, peeks his head in, and he gives this little kind of bashful smile and he says, can I play too?
Wow.
And he pulls out this ukulele that he always carries with him. And so I got to do a double ukulele accompaniment with Arlo Guthrie.
So there have to be times like that where you kind of look around to your left or to your right and you go, I can't believe this is happening to me.
I cannot believe this. You know, when I lived in New Orleans, one of my favorite songs was Good Time Charlie's Got the Blues. And it was Danny O'Keefe was the writer and singer. And when Danny O'Keefe came on to a show to perform him on stage, I got to play the guitar solo from Good Time Charlie's Got the Blues with Danny O'Keefe. Those are like really amazing moments for me. Yeah.
When you do Mountain Stage now in 2020, mm-hmm. you guys had to take a long uh-huh. break and you've finally been able to come back and bring the shows back. But it's my understanding you're doing those with no audience or very little audience.
Yeah.
Does that change the yeah. dynamic when you don't get that instant feedback from the audience?
Well, it's definitely different. You know, I guess fortunately or unfortunately for all of us in the music industry, we've discovered right off, you know, the bat that the only way we were going to get to perform was virtually. And so all of us have been doing these shows without audiences for months and months and months. So it has prepared us for this. And it's still just an absolute gas to do live music with the people in my band and with these fabulous artists. The last couple of weeks, we've gotten play with Chuck Prophet and Susan Warner and Kim Ritchie and just amazing, amazing artists. But it, you know, when you finish this big song and normally you would just, you know, just bring the house down and then there's a smattering of applause.
Right.
you know, it brings you back to the reality that we're in. But you know, I think people, hopefully that people will still enjoy what we're doing and feel the impact, even though Mountain Stage has been known for, for that one of our trademarks is it's done live before an audience, you know, without a net.
And now it's done live before the janitors without a net. So whoever's cleaning up the cultural center.
That's about it. You know, we got some of the people in the band or some of the guests to sit out in the audience in between acts. But, you know, that's where the smattering of applause comes from.
So you are probably one of, I don't know, I could count them on two hands and still have fingers left. One of a very few number of people in that state, though, that make a full-time living playing music. And you've been doing it for a long time. I wonder what's left to prove for you. What do you still want to accomplish?
Oh, well, you know, to me, Burke, it's the doing of it that's the joy. You know, I have, since the pandemic happened, I switched gears and went into my songwriting mode, because what a songwriter needs is unstructured time. Well, guess what?
Got a lot of that now.
I got a lot of that. So I have had some ideas of album concepts in my mind. So I enlisted my good friend and your good friend too, John Wickstrom, who I've written many, many songs with. And I asked him if he would like to help me create material for these projects. And we dove in, and we've turned out about 23, 24 songs and going strong. And it's just doing music. It's just playing music. It's playing with other people. It's creating. I'm a producer too. I produce albums for other people. I'm producing an album for a Morgantown singer songwriter named Chris Haddix. And I've almost always got one going if I'm not producing something of my own. And that's something I just love to do, because that's being creative and being around other musicians, and it's helping an artist bring attention to an artist who deserves attention. And so I just want to keep doing that as long as I can.
You're doing it all virtually now, I guess, you know, with John being in Baltimore and Chris being, you know, several hours away in Morgantown. You do a lot of it on Zoom, or do you share files back and forth? How do you make that work?
Yeah, John and I, you know, it works amazingly well. John and I have a FaceTime, about an hour and a half FaceTime meeting once a week. And then in between, we share audio files and lyrics and bounce ideas off of each other. And it's amazing. Writing virtually like that is almost like being in the same room together. So, you know, with that now I have a couple of studios that I work with, but I feel safe. We all stay masked and appropriately distanced and keep the numbers down to two or three people. And so I've been able to push my studio projects along in that way. But most of all, it's virtual. All my performances have been virtual. I do music for a Unity church every Sunday. I have a nice little band that we get together once a week and do our songs and drop them into the service, because they're virtual services at this point. So, yeah, it's a whole new world, and I can't wait till it's over.
Well, you're very adaptable. It's all kind of worked out for you. But if things don't work out, you've always got law school to fall back on.
Oh, yeah, I'm always something to fall back on, right?
If this music thing doesn't pan out. Hey, Ron Soul is our guest today. Hey, if folks want to find out more about you, where can they do that?
Well, you know, I had a website until recently, and I tuned into it the other day, and they had switched the services had switched, and it is gone.
Uh-oh.
So I'm having to recreate my whole website again. Of course, I've got a Facebook page, my albums are available on all the usual places, and you know, Amazon and iTunes and so forth. And you can find me on Spotify and just about any place where you find find music. But yeah, and then of course you can hear the band. They don't always introduce me on Mountain Stage, but we're on we're almost 300 stations now a week.
Bert. That's great.
And all over the country, it's a fabulous show. And if you've never heard it, you're a music lover, you really need to correct that as soon as you can, because there's some amazing performances every week.
Hey, thanks for spending time with me today. I hope you've enjoyed it.
Thank you. And somebody who survived this and is surviving it, this unusual normal that we have this day, I've really enjoyed being on with you. And good luck with your podcast.
That's my pal Ron Soule from the Mountain Stage Band. Thank you so much for listening wherever you are, whatever you do. Go out and make it a great day. Thank you, Speaker Match, for making the Big Time Talker podcast possible. I'm Burke Allen. Happy holidays, everybody.